Today's episode is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn a 5.1% annual percentage yield with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say for certain that's the highest interest rate out there, we can say that at the time of this recording, that's higher than Robinhood, higher than SoFi, Marcus, Wealthfront, higher rate than Betterment, Capital One, Ally, Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo. I think you get the point here. If you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. Full disclosures and terms and conditions can be found in the podcast description. U.S. members only.
This is Business Breakdowns. Business Breakdowns is a series of conversations with investors and operators diving deep into a single business. For each business, we explore its history, its business model, its competitive advantages, and what makes it tick. We believe every business has lessons and secrets that investors and operators can learn from, and we are here to bring them to you. To find more episodes of Breakdowns, check out joincolossus.com. All opinions expressed by hosts and podcast guests are solely their own opinions. Hosts and podcast guests may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, we are breaking down the National Football League, or as most know it, the NFL. It's a sport that dominates American Sundays from late summer into early winter. Behind what happens on the field is a $15 billion business with a unique operating and ownership structure and many stakeholders. To help break down the NFL, I'm joined by Jay Kapoor. Jay is currently general partner of venture fund VSC Ventures, and prior to his career as an investor, Jay worked in the league strategy office at the NFL. During the conversation, we break down some of the fascinating dynamics of the NFL, including how it dominates linear TV, the unique revenue considerations for the league and its teams, and what makes the NFL stand out relative to other sports. I hope you enjoy this business breakdown of the NFL. I am super excited about today's episode. If there was ever a topic that fit the business breakdowns paradigm, this is it. We're talking about a business that's extremely widely known and lots of people engage with it, but extremely poorly understood. Most people have no idea how it works. And to break it down, we're having Jay Kapoor. Welcome, Jay.
Jesse, thank you so much for having me. We've got a bear of a topic today, but I think your audience is up to it. So this will be fun.
Yeah, let's jump right in. The business we're breaking down today is the NFL. So let's just start. For those who don't know, what is the NFL?
The National Football League is the premier sports league in the United States. And they are the rights holder. And I say rights holder because we're going to talk about how that turns directly into revenue later. But they are the rights holder for professional football in the United States. There are 32 teams that make that up. Names like the Dallas Cowboys, the New York Giants, New England Patriots. But then there's also the other media properties that are a part of what makes the NFL the NFL, the Super Bowl, the draft, combine, so on and so forth. So that's, in a nutshell, what the NFL is. And it's a $15 billion revenue property that not a lot of people understand.
Give us a sense for the scale for it. So let's start more on the finance side. What's the revenue, EBITDA scale of this as if it were a business? And then let's talk a little bit more about audience size and other sort of scale metrics you think about.
Yeah, so the NFL is a bit unique in the way it operates because the operations of the day-to-day are actually happening at the team level, each of the 32 clubs. And so I'm going to use the word clubs so that we don't confuse teams, but 32 clubs that operate the individual game day. But then you also have the league office, which is where I worked for three seasons down the hall from Roger Goodell, where we actually look at the league-wide revenue. And so if you take a look at the team side revenue and the league side revenue combined, today, the NFL probably sits around $15 billion top line. You split that, I'd say roughly two-thirds league side, one-third team side. From an operating income standpoint, I think EBITDA is a little bit tough number to come into, but I can say from an operating income standpoint, costs at the NFL league side are probably $1.5 billion. So that $10 billion number dropped down to $1.5 on expenses. You're talking about $8.5 billion of operating income. That money then actually gets spread out across the 32 teams And then there's team level expenses that come into it, which is why you see teams with operating incomes of anywhere between $250 million to negative $50 million, depending on what team you are, what market you're in. So that's kind of the scale of the NFL, just in a nutshell.
Talk about growth, I guess, again, on those two levels.
Yeah, I think the biggest points of growth for the league side has been TV revenue. We're actually talking in a very interesting year because 2021 is when the new CBA got negotiated and the new TV deals for the next decade have kicked in. So just for a sense of the scale, over the next 11 years, the major TV partners are going to pay the NFL $115 billion, roughly. I'm using round numbers here. You're talking about that over 11 years, that is the big four now becoming the big five, CBS, Fox, NBC, ESPN, and now Amazon. Combined, they want to own these NFL rights because the biggest part of NFL rights is the right to broadcast NFL games. And then on top of that, historically, you've had folks like ESPN that have also paid a lot of money for the rights to highlights. So they can run things like SportsCenter, their own media properties that they've built, the 24-hour ESPN sports cycle. That is where a lot of the money is coming from on the league side. And that's where a lot of the growth has come from. On the team side, on the other hand, because the teams are actually getting revenue shared on the media end, most of their growth has come from two spots. One is sponsorship. And I think some teams like the Dallas Cowboys and the Patriots and more recently the Buccaneers have done a really great job leveraging their local level sponsorship. We'll talk more about that. But then also from seats. Interesting dynamic is that seat revenue, the hoi polloi, are actually getting their seat level revenue. And then there is what we call suite seats, the boxes. The boxes, that revenue is 100% with the teams. As a result, the more boxes you have in a stadium, and that's why you see the LA Rams and the Minnesota Vikings building large stadiums, they get to keep a lot of that revenue. And so that's where a lot of the growth has come from.
What is roughly the growth rate, if you were just to zoom out from the NFL, like last 5 years and maybe next 5 years?
5 years ago is when I left, right? I would say we were talking about somewhere around 13 and a half billion all over. And we're talking about 15 billion today. Growing, I think, pretty healthy clip year on year. But again, you have to factor that a lot of that is because today we're talking in a year where there's been a big step up in media rights. And so the NFL grows every 8 to 10 years meaningfully.
It's like a step function.
Exactly like a step function. And you can actually, if you mapped it out, and I probably have a graph somewhere, it looks exactly like a step function that steps up every 8 to 10 years.
Got it. Got it. That makes sense. Let's talk about more like the metrics associated with audience and time, like how many people watch the NFL, how much time is spent on it. Give us a sense for the scale.
There are 272 games in a 18-week NFL season. The games currently are played Thursday night, Sunday early, which is, you know, the 1 p.m. Eastern block, Sunday late, which is the 4:30 Eastern block, Sunday night, and then Monday night. And I say currently at the beginning of that because it used to just be the three Sunday slots. Then came Monday Night Football. Then more recently came Thursday Night Football. That's been a big part of the league's media expansion. The NFL became notorious because they were the only sport that literally owned one of the 7 days of the week. They owned Sunday. And now obviously have expanded that. So Thursday, Sunday, and Monday night games are prime time. So only one game is played. So only two teams. Those will average around 20, 21 million viewers each, compared to the afternoon windows on Sunday that are doing 15 to 17 million on CBS and Fox. Notable games, I think like this year, when Tampa Bay legend Tom Brady returned to New England, that one did about 28 million viewers in that game. So you will see certain primetime games that really outkick their coverage, so to speak, but you are looking at, generally speaking, 20 million primetime, 15 to 17 million in the non-primetime windows. I think time watch, Jesse, is a little bit of a weird number because it just doesn't speak to how unique the NFL is. It's such a scarcity of assets, such a low number of games compared to other leagues that I'm not sure it's that helpful, but maybe what I can share with you is 23 of the 25 most watched TV broadcast events in 2021 were NFL games. Any guess what the other two were? You probably guess one. I don't know if you'll guess both.
I'm not a big TV guy. The election?
That's good. So actually, Joe Biden's inauguration was number six. I'm not going to punish you because you wouldn't have guessed the second one. It was the airing of CBS's The Equalizer, which immediately followed the Super Bowl. So I kind of feel like that's an asterisk because that was like people left the TV on. But the equalizer came in at, I think, number 24 of the top number 25. So the NFL dominates linear TV today and makes up the vast majority of the top 100 most watched live TV events.
Let's shift a little bit. I want to talk about, for those who don't understand, including myself, sports leagues 101. Maybe talk about how the NFL is structured. And then in that explanation, what's sort of idiosyncratic to the NFL and what's normal for every league? And just kind of give us a sense for that 101.
I love this question because I think decentralization is a buzzword right now, but the NFL in a lot of ways has been operating in a decentralized co-opetition model for 6 or 7 decades. So thinking about the key stakeholders in the NFL model, I think there are probably 5. The league office, so that's where Roger Goodell sits in New York, and a few cubicles away I sat. The second is the individual clubs and their billionaire ownership groups. The third is players and players associations. That big three, I think, is a structure that you see with really any sport. Media partners, so CBS, Fox, NBC, ESPN, and now increasingly Amazon, at one point Twitter and Yahoo. These media partners, because they make up 60 to 70% of the league revenue, I think are an important stakeholder. And then lastly, maybe as a catch-all, we'll say fans, the eyeballs that are actually paying for the $15 billion engine. But you can include inside of fans probably merchandising like Nike, sponsorship like Anheuser-Busch. You can also include, you know, the new stuff that's happening with Fanatics, which is the people that run the NFL shop, or sports betting like DraftKings. So all of this is really driven by fan interest in the NFL property and why those brands really want to be aligned to it. Digging in maybe one layer deeper, the league office receives that $10 billion in shared revenue. That revenue is split equally among the 32 teams after taking out the league level costs. Then that revenue that is shared with the teams becomes the top line of the teams, which then they have to give out in a guaranteed amount to the players. What makes the NFL unique from some of the other teams, as you were asking, is the hard salary cap and the amount of rev share.
So for comparison purposes, consider that the NFL is sharing about 60% of league revenue with the teams. The NBA is probably somewhere just under 50%. And then you've got leagues like the MLB or NHL that are in the 30s or maybe even lower than that. And so that amount of revenue sharing is actually one of the things that makes the NFL so unique. And it's the same parity of revenue sharing that allows a small market team like the Jacksonville Jaguars or the Baltimore Ravens to compete with a big market team like the New York Giants or the Los Angeles Rams.
That is a very unique thing in the NFL that the NFL has really tried to cultivate, which is parity. You will hear a lot of owners, and I think Jerry Jones at one point got fined like $100,000 for talking about how revenue sharing really doesn't benefit the big market teams. So their whole thing is like, look, I am contributing a lot more to the pot, and yet you have these teams that are not really stepping up and contributing at that same level, sharing in a lot more of the revenue that I'm creating. Sounds a little bit like America, but generally speaking, that's how these owners think about it. So what they do on their end at the team level is then they sell things like sponsorship and they sell things like local level seats and that kind of stuff where they make up some of that money themselves. So the reason I give you this breakdown is because the goings on at the big three level, the individual clubs, the league office, and the players are really important and really correlated. Players need to know how much the teams are making so they can negotiate their salaries. The teams need to know how much revenue they're going to get from the league because that's how they make their operating decisions every year. And then that brings us to the next piece of it, which is the media partners. The league needs to know how much money it's making from its media rights, but the media needs to know that there is labor peace, because if they're negotiating a 10-year, $115 billion deal, they got to know there's not going to be a lockout in year 5. And so as a result, that CBA negotiation is of massive interest to the media partners that are negotiating these rights. And so you always see the CBA gets locked in, and then about a year to 18 months later, the new TV deals get locked in. And it always works in lockstep like that.
So the actual media rights, just to get into that for a second, are they a single number? And is that unique to the NFL? New York presumably generates more media viewing, or Dallas may generate more media viewing. Does more money come in for their team, but then it gets split out? Or is it all just one big...
It's one big pie, generally speaking.
And is that different than the MLB or...
Yeah, it is. It is, because the other leagues are doing some interesting stuff at the local level. So when you think about 80 plus games in the NBA, 100 plus games in the MLB. There are not enough primetime slots for those games on national television. So there is a lot more local TV that happens for those teams. And as a result, those local TV rights are being shared with regional sports networks, Comcast LA, your SNY if you're in New York, whatever the equivalent is in St. Louis. And so those folks are taking those rights. And so as a result, that revenue is staying with the teams that are actually sharing those rights. The NFL is national. First word in National Football League. And as a result, all of those games are done nationally. And so the scale of the revenues for those games are also national. And so as a result, the deals are negotiated to be shared equally among the teams. The one biggest thing that was sort of ingrained in me from sort of the first day there, this is a collective of 32 teams. But when a sponsor comes in, when an advertiser comes in and they want a sponsorship deal with the NFL, they're not trying to align with the Dallas Cowboys or with the Detroit Lions. They're trying to align with the NFL and the national scale that brings.
That's a big difference. The MLB, the Cardinals probably have their own local media. I think it's Fox Sports Midwest or whatever. They make their own deal with them. Are there other major differences in terms of the way the league is structured? Or these revenues are shared for the NFL versus other leagues?
We can go through a list of a couple of things that make the NFL unique. So we talked about revenue sharing and the hard salary cap. I think the other thing that makes it unique is that money is not guaranteed for players, whereas money is a lot more guaranteed in the MLB and in, I think, basically every other sport. I mean, NHL, NBA, a lot more of that revenue is guaranteed, especially in the case of injury, which, again, you think about a little bit ironic because one might say the NFL probably has the most injuries in aggregate, maybe not the most serious ones, but the most injuries in aggregate. They also have the largest rosters, 15 men on an NBA bench, 53 in the NFL. So the average player is also making a lot less in the NFL, even if the superstars are making quite a bit more.
And what's the background on that one and implications for that one specifically? How did that come to be? And then what are the implications from your perspective on that?
Well, I mean, a couple of implications are that the union is a lot stronger with the NFL because they have to negotiate on behalf of the lunch pail guys as opposed to the superstars. If there's 53 men on a roster, 60% of them are making a league minimum salary. So when your CBA is being negotiated, the dynamic there is that you're negotiating on behalf of the guys that maybe are only playing 3 to 4 seasons, but this money is really important to them, especially to cover, you know, long-term effects from injuries and things like that. This past CBA negotiation, you heard a lot of the superstar players get mouthy on Twitter and say, oh my God, my revenue is being cut down, or how much I can make is being capped in order to support guys that maybe only play a couple of games a season kind of thing. That doesn't really happen in other leagues. I think the other dynamic on that side is that fans of the NFL follow teams in a way that fans follow players when you talk about the NBA or the MLB. LeBron leaving Cleveland to go to Lakers took a lot of his fans with him because they were LeBron fans. You have that with rare moments like Tom Brady leaving New England to go to Tampa Bay. But generally speaking, because players are seen as a little bit more fungible in the NFL, that's a dynamic that happens as a result of not having guaranteed revenue, not having sort of long-term contract spans with these players.
Now that we have a good sense for how the NFL works, I want you to go back and give us a little bit of the history, because once upon a time, America's pastime was baseball. I'm still a huge baseball fan, but I'm curious to learn, how did the NFL come to dominate the landscape of American sports?
I love this question. I'm a history nut, so I could go on for hours. I'm going to try to condense 100 years of history, and maybe we'll just go a little bit decade by decade. But at the top, to answer your question, two big things have driven the NFL's dominance: merging with rivals and the growing value of linear TV broadcast rights. So let's start with September 17th, 1920. George Halas and other owners, they convene at a car dealership in Canton, Ohio, to form the AFPA, which later became the NFL. That NFL back in the day, you know, they had stars like Galloping Ghost Red Grange, Slingin' Sammy Baugh, and those guys made, at that time, a ridiculous $100,000 a year. That was what a professional athlete or at the NFL earned. So that continues for about a decade. 1933, you have the NFL championship game, which is created, featuring George Halas's Bears, Tim Mara's New York Giants. This goes on to later become the modern Super Bowl, but not happened for a couple of decades. Post-30s, World War II hits, and there are so few players that you actually have to have NFL teams merge. So you might have heard of the Pennsylvania Steagles because the Steelers had to merge with the Eagles because there were so few players to actually play. But coming out of World War II, there is now so much demand that a rival league, the AAFC, spins up. And that's where you have teams like Paul Brown's Cleveland Browns. They would then go on to merge with the NFL. Start to see this become a theme. So every time a rival league comes up, over time, the NFL just subsumes them, adds them as a team, brings the owners into the ownership conversation. These were now the Midwestern teams. So you're talking about the Cleveland Browns, talking about Detroit Lions, Johnny Unitas' Indianapolis Colts. And they go on to beat the New York Giants in the sudden death overtime game, still to this day called the greatest game ever played. And the reason for that, I think, is maybe less about the gameplay, but the broadcast of that Johnny Unitas Indianapolis Colts over the New York Giants game drew in millions of viewers, became the foundation of the NFL on TV today. 1960s sees the finding of another rival league called the AFL. And this is started by the Hunt family and the Kansas City Chiefs. So that AFL starts to compete with the NFL into a annual AFL-NFL game that we now call the Super Bowl. That first game was Vince Lombardi's NFL Packers against the Chiefs. And the Packers beat the Chiefs, and that became Super Bowl number one. So now we go another decade forward, 1970s. The AFL merges with the NFL. And I think this kind of created what we all as football fans sort of think of as the golden age of the NFL. So you're thinking of Mean Joe Green and the Steelers, the undefeated 72 Dolphins, Dallas Cowboys start to brand themselves as America's team. Bill Walsh starts to develop the West Coast offense. And these local heroes and storylines, they emerge as a result of the two leagues merging, basically.
And from a business perspective, what were like the big milestones? And at what point was it safe to say the NFL is bigger than the MLB?
The capstone to me of when I think the NFL really took off, and it's hard to sort of give it to one person, but I'm going to try. 1989, the NFL brought in one of the most, I think, forward-thinking owners in modern sports and possibly one of the best businessmen in America. Jerry Jones buys the Dallas Cowboys for $140 million. Today, that would be roughly $300 million inflation adjusted. Now that franchise is worth $5.5 billion. So, I mean, clearly he has done very well with it. But I think Jerry coming into the league was important because he understood that the NFL was not about the sport. The NFL was entertainment. It was more akin to wrestling than maybe people give it credit for. And I think around that time, 70s into 80s, is when you also see 24-hour sports networks, the ABC Wide World of Sports. And I think Jones and then the owners that came after him, Bob and Jonathan Kraft and the Patriots, start to realize that all of the field stuff that's happening with players, the negotiations, the trading, the rivalries, that's not a distraction from the game. That is a part of the entertainment product. And I think when the NFL embraced that, is really when it took off and nobody was catching them. So, you know, 1989, you could say was kind of an inflection point because Jerry Jones came to the table and became the blueprint for, I think, what the modern NFL owner really has become.
How do the media rights play into this, the viewership? Can you talk about how that progressed over the decades?
Over time, what we really saw was there used to be three linear TV channels, CBS, Fox, ABC. As you started to see more and more cable channels emerge, and you had the TSNs of the world and so on and so forth, the linear broadcast partners wanted something marquee that they couldn't miss. Number one sport in America around the 70s and 80s was starting to become the National Football League. So they say, okay, in order to basically keep our dominance and relevance as national media, it makes sense for us to partner with the National Football League. At the same time, the National Football League, and credit to former Commissioner Pete Rozelle for realizing this, says, okay, most of our money is coming from media rights. We need to start really working lockstep with these media partners, lock in long-term deals, and start spending against that, putting CapEx to it, so we can really grow the league property. You know, the league doesn't just expand by adding more teams. You start to see that in some international sports. You add a team, each team has a franchise fee, so on and so forth. The league grows by adding games, adding properties, but the biggest thing that stays consistent, or at least the league wants to stay consistent, is the quality of the product, the quality of the game. And so if they kept the quality high, the media partners keep coming to it. Now, fast forward a couple decades, and you're now in a streaming era where there is no appointment viewing. I think after Game of Thrones ended, there really hasn't been anything from a scripted content standpoint that has become appointment viewing, right? We all talk about Squid Game for 2 weeks, and then that's it. Whereas the NFL is a 365-day-a-year sport, and it becomes appointment viewing. And so for the media partners, as they're thinking about what are the rights I need to own, the NFL, because of its scarcity, starts to keep increasing in value.
And can you talk a little bit about the game schedule and how that makes it even a more scarce resource, or how that creates unique scarcity?
So this is a really fun story. And this was, I think, one of my favorite days when I got to the NFL, because I got to go down to scheduling and see actually like the big board of how they do it. So for about 30 years, the NFL schedule was handled by one guy. Val Pinchbeck was his name. I don't know if you've seen the movie Dune, but it was like the Mentats from Dune. Like, he would just sit in front of a big board and he would run calculations in his head and he would go, Patriots, Buccaneers, week 4. And he would just put it on there. And the reason this was so impressive was because these stadiums are not just used for football. They got concerts. They have the Westminster Dog Show. They have all these other things that are happening. They conflict with a Sunday night schedule. And then when it goes from just Sunday to Thursday and Monday, you're now talking about working around multi-million dollar projects that these teams are doing in order to basically finance the cost of billion-dollar stadiums. So over time, this expanded to actually being computed. The scheduling team, Howard Katz, Mike North, they built these algorithms that would simultaneously run different variables. What happens if we put a rivalry game, Packers-Vikings this day, and then the next day is Cowboys-Giants? Okay, but then we don't have enough rivalry games in the back half of the season. Okay, let's space them out. Let's do that kind of thing. So they go through billions of permutations. There's a really great video, we can link it if folks want to watch it, that the NFL created on how they run these permutations, work with AWS to plug right into the servers and run these things at night. And then they share it with the commissioner. And the commissioner says, oh, you know what? Actually, I don't really love this. So they go back and they run the variables again. Or Taylor Swift has her reunion tour in LA that day, and she's going to be taking over SoFi. Okay, the Rams can't have a home game. But let's say you move it around, and now the Rams are on the road 3 weeks in a row. You can't have that either. So all these different variables add up. Scheduling, I think, is one of the most fascinating aspects of how the NFL really makes it work, because they are trying to not counter-program against something that would take away from the value of that national audience.
And because there's so few games, each game is that much more scarce and more interesting, which then sort of it all kind of keeps flowing into the value of that 23 out of 25 we talked about earlier.
100%. I mean, it's this interesting dance that you have to do, because there were 256 games. Now there are 272. Obviously, that has brought in additional revenue into the league. But one additional game also has a lot of wear and tear on the athlete's body. It's also a lot more from an operating income standpoint, where you have to run another game and another game day. And so there is an interesting balance that teams have to strike in terms of how many more games can we add before we start to lose that scarcity value and each game maybe starts to lose a little bit of its relevance.
I want to go a little bit, we've talked a little bit about the P&Ls and stuff, but I want to go one or two levels deeper into them. So let's start with the league. So you talked about the league, it's $10 or $11 billion a year in media rights, and their costs are $1.5 billion on top of that. Are there any other sources of revenue at the league level?
So the $10 billion a year at the national level is media and then some. So let's actually break it down a little bit more. So media rights can actually be broken down into a couple of components, the biggest of which is the $5 billion or so the league is getting from CBS, NBC, Fox, ESPN, and now Amazon. So that's just $5 billion to broadcast rights, we can call them. Then there's NFL Sunday Ticket, which for a long time was on DirecTV. We don't know where it could be next year. That's worth about $1.5 billion just for DirecTV to have the rights to broadcast all the games and sell a subscription package against it. That's how they make their money. On top of that, the NFL is unique in a way because they have their own media entity, NFL Network. And for a long time, NFL Network actually incubated Thursday Night Football before they spun it off into its own billion-dollar property. That plus NFL Red Zone, some folks might be familiar with, that altogether, probably $700 million just from the owned and operated media assets. So now we're talking about, what, 6.5 plus 7? So we're already roughly, call it $7.25 billion just from media. There's other media aspects to it, but I'm going to bucket them a little bit differently, like Super Bowl and postseason. It'll be a better breakdown. So for media at 7.25, we go to consumer products, your Nike jerseys, your car decals, all those sort of different branded products that you see.
That's all league level, though. That's not...
That's all league level. So that's $500 million that you are getting just in consumer products. Sponsorship, So Anheuser-Busch, Bridgestone, Pepsi, Verizon, so on and so forth. That's another half a billion. So now we're talking around $8.5 billion total. Digital media, the NFL app, fantasy, any of that stuff, probably another $500,000. What are we at now? I hope you're keeping a running tally. So I think we said 7.25.
Nine and change,
right? Okay, good. So I'm on track. Postseason. So this is where some of the media overlaps a little bit, but you're talking about playoffs and Super Bowl. Super Bowl, and we can talk about it a little bit deeper because it's one of my favorite topics. That's like a $200 million property in and of itself. But add on to that playoffs, you're talking about a $300 million property, all at the national level. So now we're at about nine and a half. International, there's three games in the UK. There's international streaming rights that are sold to different countries. So now we're coming up on, call it 9.7. Sports betting, which is a new thing this year, added somewhere between 250 to 300 million to the top line. So now we're up on 10. And then I think you'll tack on a couple other investments, joint ventures, some small revenue projects, stuff that they did with NFL On Location, probably another 100 to 200 million. So that's really how we make up the total 10 million top line. But 7.25, as we said, really just attributed directly to media, whether it's the O&O properties or the licensed properties.
So the costs are only 1.5 billion. I guess, what are the major buckets of costs at the national level?
The NFL, at least when I was there, I don't think it's grown that much, is only around 1,100 employees. And the bulk of that cost is Roger Goodell's salary. No, I'm kidding. It's much deeper than that. It's obviously running the league operations. You've got teams that are going to games. You have folks that are instituting the salary cap. You have marketing and sponsorship folks. But a lot of it is personnel costs. It's headcount. On the NFL Network side, you have some more production and CapEx that has to go in every year in order to really operate the NFL Network at a high level. But the cool thing about the league is that a lot of the costs, the human costs, are actually down to the team level. So if it's only $1.5 billion in cost, then the $8.5 billion is being split 32 ways.
I'm still trying to get my head around the $1.5 billion. Even if you're paying the average employee 200 grand on that, that's not $200 million. Are games really expensive to produce? Like, what else is making up that big dollar amount? Are there cost of sales in certain places?
You got to include cost of sales. I mean, if you're thinking about sponsorship, you have the actual assets that you're physically paying for. It's out of home, things like that. Even on the network side, if you are just setting up a network and running a network, there's a few hundred million dollars of costs that come out of that piece. You have to sort of factor in on location, travel for people, expenses from that standpoint.
What does it cost to run a game, roughly?
Probably talking about somewhere on the order of 5 to 10 million. And it's a wide range because you have teams like the Dallas Cowboys where every event is a massive party and there's all these different things that happen. And then teams that are maybe a little bit less profitable, like the Detroit Lions and the Buffalo Bills, that are maybe not going as all out to run a game. I'm sure some of those cost structures have changed from what I remember. That's sort of the level that you're talking about from an operational standpoint at the teams. And so the $1.5 billion also includes a little bit of the cost of sales, but it also includes the actual sort of like day-to-day operations of a league. Draft is a massive media property. That takes some revenue to run. Combine is another massive property that the NFL has created and now has sold broadcast rights against, but they still have to like rent out a massive stadium and run the thing. So rent ends up actually being a lot of the cost because they have to take out these assets to then build a platform to sell revenue against it.
One last thing on the league level, and then I want to talk about the team. So you're the commissioner, obviously renegotiating media rights and that step function as a way to grow this business. Are there other major drivers or things that you would do to drive the top line of the overall NFL? Big needle moving things?
There are a couple things. So every year, the league probably comes in with a bulk of the revenue contracted and guaranteed. But then there's a lot of stuff happening on upsells, digital media upsells, sponsorship upsells. You did one activation with Anheuser-Busch, but hey, we have another creative idea that we can do another activation with you. The total cost of that activation can be negotiated over the course of the season, but probably adds 30 to 40 million to the top line. There are interesting things that are happening around ticketing, where the league is trying to figure out how do they do dynamic ticketing so that as you get closer to a game, if the game becomes more valuable in the playoff picture, you can adjust pricing and do kind of stuff that way. So there are a lot of things that teams would do and the teams we worked with would do to figure out how do we grow that sort of non-contracted piece of the pie. And you would typically have targets against it where you say, look, we don't have a home improvement sponsor. Okay, that's a new sponsorship that we can add in this season working with Lowe's and Home Depot. Okay, there isn't an official watch sponsor. Wonder what Timex or Rolex or whoever are thinking. How do we add that? So sponsorship's a good way. Events are a good way. We haven't really dug into this, but the NFL really excels at taking cost centers and turning them into media properties. So what is the NFL draft? Why do we actually have to have an event? We could just do this all from Zoom on our couches, but the NFL creates a three-day party in every city where people show up. There's a massive event. There's a massive media broadcast package. ESPN and NFL Network pay to cover it for all that time. That was just a cost center. And now it's a $100 million property potentially. Combine, I think, is headed that way. What is the combine? It's college players working out for 3 days. Why the hell do we care? And yet they have turned that into from a cost center to a revenue center. I think of Amazon in some ways. I think it's really interesting, right? People think about what was AWS. AWS was created for internal Amazon purposes and then has now turned into possibly $1 trillion business in its own right. Kind of the same thing with the NFL, maybe at a smaller scale. Anything that the NFL is doing for its own purposes, it will find a way to get some eyeballs on it because it thinks it can sell revenue on it.
That's awesome. So now I'm a team owner or team GM. The first step is I get my, I guess, roughly 300 million or so, or I guess maybe not 300, it's 8 billion divided by 32. So 250 million, something like that. I get my share. What percentage of my revenue is that league rev share?
So 275 million is roughly what every NFL team got this year as part of that revenue share. So times that by 32 teams, you get to the roughly $8.5 billion in league-side operating income. Now, a good chunk of that has to be given out to players, but to answer your question directly, the league-side revenue amount could make up somewhere between 60 and 70% of a team's top-line revenue. I think in a non-pandemic year, most of the teams are doing somewhere between 400 and 500 million in top-line revenue. And that includes the 275 roughly that they are getting from the equal share from the league.
The Dallas Cowboys, and I keep using the Cowboys because they are the number one team, but I think it helps show you the disparity. Swap that in for the Patriots too, because they're right up there. Those teams are doing between 150 to 200 million of local level sponsorship. Like, it's a very interesting dynamic, right? Verizon is the national NFL sponsor, official data partner of the NFL. But the Cowboys play in AT&T Stadium. So it's a very, very interesting dynamic where you have a national level sponsor, but then that same asset is being packaged in a different way. Pepsi is the NFL sponsor. Coke is the official sponsor of the Cowboys. Like, it's just very, very interesting how these dynamics work. So they sell close to $200 million in sponsorship revenue. The Buffalo Bills, Cincinnati Bengals, Detroit Lions, they're not doing as much from a local level sales standpoint. If you are a big stadium or you have just recently built a big stadium, then that piece of the national revenue, probably a smaller piece of your pie, maybe closer to 60%, because you are actually going out and selling suite seats, corporate suites, and you keep 100% of that revenue, whereas ticketing revenue is split 2/3, 1/3 between the team and the league. So the suite seat side is a huge reason why you see a lot of teams, as they start doing well, go in to build new stadiums. And then they go to the city and they say, hey, please give us a lot of tax breaks or we're going to move to LA. That's, I think, an interesting way that the teams look at their own P&Ls and say, where are the variables? I know I'm getting 60% of my revenue from the league every year. Great. I'm going to use that and I'm going to earmark most of that because I got to pay players' salaries. We'll talk about that in a second. But then the rest of it is advertising, sponsorship, local seats, any sort of other activations they do. They have their own media. Jerry Jones had his own podcast at one point. Great. That's all team revenue.
So line item number one is the league rev share, obviously. What's line item number two typically? Is it seat ticket? What would that look like for a typical team?
I would say you're probably doing between 40 and 50 million in seat revenue in a normal year. You can kind of think about what an average seat costs, 60,000 seats in a stadium. On top of that, add what the suite would cost, maybe $5,000 to $8,000 per game, And then what's that, 50 to 60 suites in a modern stadium? And then obviously you have special ground level seats. You have field passes, owner's box, and special tickets that way. But then you have to count concessions. And that's a big part of what makes up an NFL team's game day revenue. Because of the pandemic, we actually got a look into what revenue impact was for teams that played without any fans in the stadium. And across an 8-game home season, teams lost between $100 and $250 million in stadium revenue. And concessions as well as tickets is what makes up a massive piece of that. And then you obviously have some teams that are doing dynamic seating. So as the season changes and maybe some teams become red hot later in the season, so they're able to change ticket prices late season in real time in order to increase their team side revenue numbers that year. But I think it really depends. You know, when you have teams that have brand new stadiums, that's probably when ticketing is going to be the number one revenue generator. But then for other teams that have maybe older stadiums, sponsorship and concessions probably makes up a much larger piece of that overall team revenue.
Let's talk a little bit about that stadium dynamic you're mentioning with the cities and stuff. Who owns the stadium and how does that whole part of the equation work from like a cost perspective and a management perspective?
A little bit outside my pay grade, but I'm going to try my best. So generally speaking, these stadiums are now $2 to $3 billion assets. There is usually a holding company that owns those. That holding company is probably majority owned by the team or the billionaire team owner. Sometimes it's a JV. So I think the Rams Stadium, because the Chargers and the Rams both play there. You have a similar dynamic here in New York with MetLife because the Jets and the Giants play there. So it's not owned by any one team. It's a JV with the team and then probably some sort of real estate developer that has financed the project up front. Then you get tax breaks in order to keep the team there because you feel like, okay, not only are we building a stadium, but we're also adding all these other services around it and there's a theme park and yada, yada, yada. And that is the reason why you should give us some benefit onto the building the stadium there. The land is another conversation entirely because that land ownership could actually be the city. It could also be a private owner. And then you have to negotiate, okay, how are we actually generating revenue and, you know, paying back the land rights? And so there's kind of different levels, right? There's the land, there's the city that you're in, there's the stadium itself, there's the holding company. Each constituent is hoping that this generates more revenue and the city is hoping that it generates more taxes that the city can then benefit from because putting that stadium there brought people to Inglewood or wherever the stadium is, and that brought prosperity to that neighborhood kind of thing.
And on the team's P&L, do they just pay a rent line item for that? Or is it a per game? Or is it related to ticket revenue?
I think it's generally a rent line item. I think you are renting your space from the holding company. Now, it just so happens that you are a part owner of the holding company, but I think that's probably the right way to think about it.
Super interesting. Now let's talk about the cost side. So I'm going to summarize what I heard. I think I'm an NFL team owner. My top line is probably about 500 million, might be 700, might be 400. Most of that's coming from my rev share. I also sell some ticket revenue in the $25 to $100 million range. I also sell sponsorships and maybe events, local events and some other things. Now let's talk about my costs.
Biggest line item is the salary cap. For simplicity, let's assume every team spends up to the salary cap, which we know is not true. But if every team spends up to the $183 million salary cap, then that $275 that's guaranteed revenue from the league minus the $83 leaves you about $90 million of quote, operating income that's non-player related. Then you've got the actual cost to operate each game. And this is just operating costs, right? Because some games, you may be operating for $10 million a game, but you're also generating a lot of revenue because you've got kickoff and tailgate sponsorship and that kind of stuff. But just on a cost standpoint, let's say it's a couple million that you're running for the game. Then there's the cost to just keep the lights on, operate the entire stadium, operate the grounds crew, get the thing looking like the billion-dollar property that it is. There's a lot of that. And then there's the human costs, dialing for dollars that are calling people to renew their season ticket packages, the sponsorship teams that are going out there and trying to sell local-level sponsorship and advertising. If the teams have their own media entities and media properties, you know, like the Giants do, like the Cowboys do, that is another cost center. And so from that standpoint, it's why you see a massive variance in operating income.
So the Cowboys and Patriots have maybe revenue of, let's say, $500 or $600 million a year, and operating income comes in a normal year, somewhere between $150 and $300 million. So that's the biggest teams. But in a pandemic-adjusted year, we had teams that had negative operating income. I think the Green Bay Packers, typically a team that is doing somewhere around $70 to $100 million in operating income, had negative operating income in 2020. It really depends on the market, and I think it depends on how much you rely on ticketing revenue as a part of your overall team revenue. And it depends in the investment that you have made in the stadium.
You know, Shad Khan and the Jacksonville Jaguars actually have like $68, $75 million in operating income. And the reason is they have, one, invested in that whole complex area around the stadium. They have invested in media properties. They have really invested in growing the Jacksonville Jaguars brand in that part of Florida. Not every team is doing that, and not every team historically has done that. And so you kind of see a little bit of, I think, dichotomy now between the inherited owners, the folks who their grandfathers and great-grandfathers were founding the team back in the 1920s, like we talked about, and then some of the new owners that have come in, I'd say, since the 90s, that are really actually thinking of their team not as a cash cow, but actually as an asset that they have to invest in and sort of grow.
It's interesting because there's a lot of fixed costs and even fixed revenue if you're an NFL owner. So how do you think about operating leverage if you're running a franchise like this? Sounds like media properties is one that you've said a few times. Are there other forms of operating leverage in this business?
You're starting to see the teams, especially around sports betting, we're trying to do some interesting things where they're trying to bring in new models. You've seen teams flirt with NFTs. I think they're trying to figure out, hey, can we NFT a game-winning jersey from Tom Brady or an Ndamukong Suh on the Buccaneers and sell that in some interesting way? A lot of operating leverage, honestly, man, comes from the stadiums. This is the biggest lever. Like, yeah, you could make low single, maybe double-digit million, call it like variables. But really what you want to do if you are a team that is on the rise is build a new stadium because you get to sell more suites. And the suites are where you end up generating that revenue. And if you're doing well as a team and you build a new stadium, then you actually have more out-of-home inventory that you can sell sponsorship and advertising against. Your old stadium maybe only has 7 billboards. Your new one has 21. Okay, now you've 3x the real estate that you can sell some advertising against. This new stadium thing isn't just, oh, the old one is old. It's the old one is old and doesn't have enough inventory for us. And that's why these teams are investing in building new stadiums every couple of years.
Let's talk about the governance model of the NFL, because as far as businesses go, it's incredibly unique. What is a commissioner? Why is he not a CEO? Who does he answer to? How does he answer to them? Just give us a sense for how the governance works here and maybe contrast it with a typical corporation.
A typical corporation is very top down. And so what you're kind of seeing is CEO and the executive board set the agenda, and then the sort of overall teams go on and they execute it. What you see at the NFL level, and I would say compared to some of the other leagues that I've seen, that decision-making, because so much of the revenue is guaranteed and shared, is actually centralized to the league office with the approval of the 32 team owners. So it's almost like thinking about every quarter, present a plan to the commissioner blesses it, he takes it to the board of 32 high ego, high net worth individuals, ultra high net worth individuals, and then they talk about how do they actually execute this plan that all of them will share in equally. And you can imagine that when you have Kansas City Chiefs and the Seattle Seahawks at the same table with the Cowboys and the Washington Professional Football Team, and these are very, very different markets, very, very unique operating models. The teams don't really share best practices with each other because they're competitors. So if I'm doing something in Houston, I don't want somebody in Indianapolis or Minnesota to know. You can see why not everybody gets on the same page. So generally, from a governance standpoint, what you see is there are committees. You have a digital media committee. You have a compensation committee. You have a postseason and sponsorship committee. And so those committees will say, okay, we have gone over the plans. There's enough representation from each of the ownership groups to say, okay, we agreed this is the go forward on digital media. And then at the annual meeting, everybody comes together and sort of okays the plan. But it's very different. I mean, imagine every major decision that you had to do, you not only had to go to your board and share it with them, but you had to get buy-in from a majority of the board to do it. And today, with a lot of tech companies where, pardon me, but I think a lot of boards are like rubber stampers. That is not the case with the NFL. With the NFL, you have to get buy-in. And, you know, there are louder voices at the table and there are quieter voices at the table. And it just all comes back to, you were talking about 32 very different markets, but equally large egos.
Does it end up just being a majority rule vote kind of thing? Is that what does it? Or does Roger Goodell end up having a lot more power than a typical chief executive would have because there's such a diverse group of board directors? There's 32 board directors.
There are probably owners that exert a little more vocal power than others. I'm not going to name any, but you can probably correlate it with the ones that have the highest valuations of their teams. They are a bigger part of what makes the NFL the NFL, and so they have a larger voice in what they say. Yeah, I think generally speaking, there's consensus-based votes. Publicly, you will never hear the league say it was down to a 21-22 vote. Very rarely, you'll say 30 of the 32 teams agreed or 31 of the 32 teams agreed. And that's usually because there is some sort of inherent conflict of interest. Hey, we're going to do XYZ to change the rules, but we're doing it specifically because the Patriots were caught with Spygate. Okay, well, the Patriots aren't going to just abstain from the vote kind of thing, right? So that's when you hear sort of public stuff around competition. I would say behind closed doors, it's probably like, okay, well, the majority of the voting block has said we're going to do this. And then the memo in the press release kind of says everybody was on board. It's the commissioner's job. And I know a lot of people have a lot of opinions about them, but he has really done his job well since 2006 to be the public face of the league, to be the criticism shield for the owners, and to really shepherd this process through so that everybody gets consensus. Then he's able to go back to his lieutenants at the league level and say, okay, let's execute upon this plan. Let's get us to the $27 billion revenue goal that we have, or $25 billion revenue goal by 2027. And so that is his job. His job is really a moderator and consensus maker. And then at times, player discipline and other things that he's had to do as well.
What does his executive team look like underneath him? Is it like a typical executive team, or talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's generally the same. I would liken it to anything else. The CFO's team, which is the team that my group was under. You've got your head of media, you've got your head of international, your head of sponsorship. Generally the same thing, COO and a CMO and so on and so forth. So I think from that standpoint, it's pretty standard. Again, the assets that they are looking at maybe are a little bit different from a traditional company.
And what's his relationship? I mean, I assume the owners obviously are decision makers, but they're also owners. With the GMs or with really the mini CEOs of every team, does he have some kind of a reporting relationship with them, or how does that work?
No, it kind of stops at the team level. There are teams at each ownership level that are corresponding with the league. So my group was really doing league level revenue, league strategy, and financial planning. We had a team called Club Strategy, and they worked with the individual 32 teams. And so they would say, okay, hey, we're looking at Oakland's, back when they were Oakland, now they're Las Vegas, but we were looking at your revenue numbers and we feel like your ticket numbers are soft. Let's work with you to actually bring those up. And they would almost do like office hours with each of the teams, each of the club's individual teams, and say, okay, sponsorship, you guys are good. Ticketing, maybe a little bit soft. Game day, event revenue, top 10 percentile. But they would actually make sure the teams were... So there's consultative services between the league and the individual clubs. And we worked on some of that, but generally speaking, kind of stops once you get to the ownership.
Speaking of the talent, we talked about the collective bargaining agreement earlier, noted that NHL may be as low as 20%, the NFL is all the way at 60%. First of all, talk about what a collective bargaining agreement is, you know, why they work and how they work and why they're so unique. Why is the NFL the highest of all?
I think there's a couple of threads that we can pull on here. And if folks want to go deeper, we actually had the president of the NFLPA on my podcast, The Game Plan, last season. And so if you want to listen to Eric Winston talk about it, he goes even deeper. But the collective bargaining agreement is the governing document by which the players agree to play for the National Football League and the member clubs. And these include things like how much players can be paid, how those income agreements will step up over time, what the revenue share looks like. Historically, players had, let's say, 45% of revenue. Most recently, it was about 47% of overall league revenue must go to the players. Now, with the new 17-game season kicking in, that's even been a step up. Eric was a big part of negotiating. Okay, once it goes to 17, that steps up to 48% with additional revenue kickers to 49%. So the players are actually getting about 50% of league revenue that is mandated that the teams must spend. So you don't have the situation where the teams can just go ahead and pocket the league revenue and then say, okay, you know what, we're going to put on a subpar product and so on and so forth. The league actually makes sure that everybody is staying competitive. And one of the ways they do that is by starting everybody off with the same amount of money at the start of the season and then saying, okay, good, go sell sponsorship to add to that. And then maybe you can afford Kyler Murray's contract or anything like that. And so that's the one place that it starts. Why it is this way and why it's not guaranteed the way the NBA and MLB is, I think has a lot to do with historically how the contracts were negotiated. The NFL really is a team sport, whereas I think some of these other leagues are superstar driven. And you're seeing that change a little bit in the social media era with the NFL, where you have these big names, the Aaron Rodgers, the Dak Prescotts, and so on. But that has always been the case in the NBA. And so the NBA would go and negotiate these contracts individually. And you didn't have as much of a string of players that were on the minimum contract, the veteran minimum, so on and so forth. As I mentioned, I think in the NFL, 60 to 65% of a roster is on the minimum contract. Therefore, you need a much stronger union and a much stronger CBA that guarantees that those players are actually getting that floor price of their work. Because the human body is the human body. Whether you're a superstar or you're the third stringer, injury is the same to you. And so you have to make sure that there's at least a certain level of benefits, of healthcare, of revenue, of long-term care post-retirement that these players are able to get, you know, collect a pension, so to speak, they're able to get. All of that is negotiated in the CBA. But then the CBA also includes things like HGH testing and how often you can be tested, disciplinary issues. I used to work at the NFL back in 2014 when the Ray Rice situation happened. How much power does the commissioner actually have versus how much the teams have? Because the teams might take some of these issues and put a slap on the wrist. But the NFL is trying to protect the shield and brand image. And they know that their sponsorship partners might walk away. And so they have to have different disciplinary power to be able to discipline players. That is all negotiated in the CBA. That's why it's a very contentious and long process every 10 years.
And the NFL Players Association is effectively a union. It's not an entity that's owned by anything, or it's not a corporation or anything like that.
No, it's a players union that negotiates on behalf of all the players. They have team reps, then they have an executive committee, and then they have a president, which is an active player. But then they also have their whole cadre of lawyers that are the ones that actually do the negotiation on behalf of the players. And so league level reps are actually going and talking to everybody in the locker room. They're saying, what are your issues? They raise it to the executive committee. Executive committee raises it to the president and the lawyers, and then they go and negotiate it with their counterparts in player operations inside the league.
There was one question that's been lingering in my mind. Earlier, you mentioned that Jerry Jones bought the Cowboys for $140 million or $300 million in today's money, and now it's worth $5.5 billion, and yet the operating income is, say, $150 million. I think I know the answer, but I'm curious, how does enterprise value get created, and why is enterprise value growing so fast for these teams?
It's a couple of reasons, man, but scarcity is the number one. There is only one Dallas Cowboys. There is only one of 32 NFL teams. In order to buy a team, you must be approved by the existing ownership group. Probably a month ago or whenever this whole Constitution Dow thing happened, you had some people that said, oh, well, you know, we lost the Constitution. Maybe we can buy a piece of the Miami Dolphins. And it's like, okay, just take a breath for a second. This is a very, very exclusive club. And you must be approved into it. And if Jeff Bezos tomorrow wanted to buy the Seattle Seahawks, he still has to go and kiss the ring of Jerry Jones and of Dan Snyder and of Tim Mara and all the other folks. That exclusivity creates enterprise value. And then add on top of that, the exclusivity of there are only 272 games. They all play on national TV. Those national TV rights only continue to be more valuable because until we figure out another appointment viewing thing, it's live sports and the NFL is the king of live sports. And so that exclusivity at every level continues to create enterprise value. But credit to Jerry, what he's also done is up their sponsorship, built AT&T Stadium, this what he calls the Mecca of football down in Dallas, Texas. And he's created this massive party every game day where people come from around the world, not just around the country, to attend this event. A lot of enterprise value gets created based off the brand value that's associated with what each team is doing at the team level.
When you take away this unique scarcity or trophy aspect to a team, what's your perspective on if you were to use the future cash flows growth and these things are trading at 40 times those earnings or something like that? How do you think about that?
It's so hard, man. I don't know if you can assign a multiple on revenues to these teams. We said the revenue is somewhere between 400 and 600 million, 275 guaranteed from the league, and then probably another somewhat contracted every year. Then you're adding on your season tickets and that kind of stuff. Okay, so if we're talking about, again, let's just use the Cowboys. They're the exception, not the rule. $5.5 billion, but they're starting with $500 million, give or take, of league level operating income, which becomes their top line operating revenue. 11x, 12x. I mean, it's weird. So like, don't quote me on it. I just don't think you can assign standard revenues that way to get a multiple. But yeah, I mean, probably trade somewhere between 11 and 12x. But again, some of that is because of the massive investment that he's made. If we went to look at a mid-market team like the Houston Texans, not that far away, they haven't done as much. They haven't invested as much, but they're in a somewhat similar market, you would say, demographically. They're probably doing $400 million. Their franchise value is $3.5 to $4 billion. So yeah, they're trading maybe between 10 and 11x as well. The teams that are investing are probably trading at slightly higher multiples as well.
A lot of it must be the trophy thing, right? Because they're trading like solidly growing SaaS businesses that might exist for a long time, and interesting thing to think through. There's this word you used a lot when we were prepping for this call. The word was relevance. Talk about what you meant by that, or what does relevance mean, and why is it important, and what's going to happen with the NFL in that word?
When we were doing the like, what are the five stakeholders? I mentioned it was the league, the clubs, the players, the media partners, and then last but not least was the fans. Well, the fans are a really important part of why there is this ancillary ecosystem of companies built around the NFL. Whether you talk about DraftKings and FanDuel or Fanatics or any of the other properties that are created, the fans have to have relevance with the league. Why does NFL media rights generate $5 billion in national revenue, whereas the NBA generates $2 billion? It's because the eyeballs. It's because there's 115 million people tuning in for the Super Bowl, which blows any other metric for sports viewership out of the water. Why is relevance so important? Well, because that would be the biggest threat to why the NFL doesn't continue to dominate in the next two decades. The NFL, one of the things we didn't talk about, what makes it unique, as a sport, Jesse, it is built for TV. There are whistled breaks every few minutes that create an ad unit. And that ad unit then turns into revenue for the partners. Well, if we are all moving towards streaming, Netflix, no advertising world, does the NFL product still have relevance? Is a three-hour game still relevant for our TikTok attention span? I don't know the answer to that, right? I think the NFL is trying to do interesting things where their highlights, their clips. I think NFL Red Zone was genius because I care about my New York Giants. I'm going to watch that game. But I'm also a football fan, but I don't want to sit through advertising to watch clips of the Miami Dolphins. Great. NFL Red Zone is the perfect 8 hours that I can just veg out and watch football. So they're doing interesting things to, I think, keep in lockstep with how tastes are changing. But you also have to consider like what the average age of a fan group is. I think the average age of an NFL fan today, maybe these numbers are outdated, but probably somewhere in the high 50s. 55 is the average age of an NFL fan. Compare that to the average age of an NBA fan is 44. Why? There is a lot larger, younger fan base in the NBA because the NBA embraced digital media and social media a lot faster than the NFL did. MLB is probably in the 60s in terms of their fan base. NHL, I would say probably somewhere between the NFL and the NBA. Slightly younger fans, but also the old school diehards. How do you go from 55 to 44? You have to be where your audience is at. And that's why I think the NFL has, you know, done partnership with Snapchat, with Twitter, with Twitch and Amazon. They're trying to be where the eyeballs are. The question remains whether the game product itself is going to have to change to maintain relevance with how people consume media today.
The NBA example, just one thing I wanted to clarify, you said 2 billion versus 5 billion. If you were to add up all the teams selling their individual regional media rights and the national, would that compare to the NFL or is it still much smaller?
It may, but you also have to think about the scale of audience. The Minnesota Timberwolves, maybe they're getting a couple million viewers for a local game. The Minnesota Vikings are getting 15 million for a game that plays later that night or that afternoon. There's still levels to this in terms of audience. So yes, maybe there are more games, but the NBA on a per game basis is making less revenue than the NFL on a per game basis.
Right. That makes sense. One question around relevance. I mean, obviously there's this whole shift to streaming and this business models innovating. Is the NFL thinking about embracing like a D2C model? And
this would be speculation on my end. I left 5-6 years ago now, but I think there is a little bit of an innovator's dilemma with doing that. NFL Sunday Ticket is probably the closest thing that the NFL has to a subscription product. And that is not an owned and operated property. That is a licensed property to DirecTV. And now in the future to ESPN and Plus and some other folks that are going to be bidding on it. If they were to O&O it, one thing they have to do is then take on the cost structure of actually running this product, which they haven't done and haven't had to do for 2 decades whenever they launched that deal. They would also cannibalize their partnerships with the existing media partners. I think long term, there are probably benefits to it, but sometimes it's like turning a massive oil tanker or just an aircraft carrier. It's just going to take a long time. And so maybe it could make sense for them to go fully direct. But my sense is more likely the way the NFL has at least historically operated, they are going to license and partner those rights with D2C operators. And by the way, you're starting to see that already, right? Because Fox has their own online streaming entity. CBS has launched Paramount Plus. I don't know if they have games yet, but one can assume they probably will soon. Hulu has live sports, and so maybe there's some partnership work there. Peacock for NBC. So that to me seems more like the route that they would go, which is to say, okay, you get the broadcast rights for all the people that don't own a smartphone, but then we also get some additional revenue from you because you've now created new inventory on a digital streaming platform. I don't think they're going to go ad-free, though. Advertising is just a massive, massive part of what makes the NFL what it is. We talked about why the game is purpose-built for 30-second ad spots. It'd be really, really hard to go away from it. Whereas like when you think about the NBA, you really only get ads in timeouts. And you really only get ads when the quarters change over. It's different with the NFL. And that ad inventory is a big part of what makes the league what it is.
Switching gears, let's talk about the Super Bowl. It's one of the most unique cultural phenomenons out there. Can you talk about how did the NFL create it? How did it come to be what it is? Your perspective on it?
Yeah, I mean, think about it for a second, right, Jesse? We take the biggest sporting event of the year and then we stop it in the middle for 45 minutes for a Rihanna concert. Nobody does this. Like, there is nothing like this in the world. And we have now had this property that at its peak generated 115 million viewers. And that was the Patriots-Seahawks Super Bowl in 2015. I think recently, this past year, pandemic adjusted, but was probably around 96 million viewers. So you're somewhere in that 100 million viewer range for the Super Bowl. If the NFL is a $15 billion property across the teams and leagues, the Super Bowl is probably a $200 million property. Why does it get that? Well, it gets that because of the massive, massive viewership, which really blows anything away. I mean, if you want to compare the NFL viewership numbers for a second, there is no real single game out there that can match it. The only other entities that I can think of, single event entities, the Rugby World Cup probably globally does 600 million viewers. We haven't really talked about international. Like globally, that's probably the biggest opportunity for the NFL. But the FIFA World Cup says they do 3 billion viewers. Okay, that's over the course of a month. Tour de France says they do 3.5 billion. Like those numbers sound juiced. I don't know if I believe that. 3.5 billion for Tour de France seems a little crazy. But the NFL is a single game, is a single appointment viewing entity, earns the hundreds of millions that it's getting. And we've all heard about the ad spots. That money doesn't drop to the NFL. That is with the broadcast partners. So in order to get the ability to charge $6 million for a 30-second ad spot, the broadcast partners have to pay the NFL for the right to broadcast the Super Bowl. So they do that. Then you have the Pepsi halftime show. And Pepsi pays the NFL in order to brand and market the Pepsi halftime show. You have all the other sponsors that will partner with the NFL specifically for the Super Bowl. And what I love about the Super Bowl as a former employee, the game itself was the least interesting part of the Super Bowl because the Super Bowl is football Coachella. It is a 4-day or week-long party. It is an event and you are bringing your sponsors. If you are a NFL fan, this is where you bring somebody if you're trying to close a massive multi-million dollar deal with them. These tickets, they go for $4,000 to $6,000 for the lower ring and $1,500 to $2,000 for the upper bowls. they're worth every penny because, again, it is a very, very unique experience and unique asset. There used to be a thing called NFL House, which when it was here in New York, it was, you know, in a nice hotel, and you would have players come and you would bring your partners that you're trying to close with a deal. You say, hey, you're a Buffalo Bills fan? Why don't we go meet Jim Kelly? Right? Oh, you're a Pittsburgh Steelers fan? Oh, look, Jerome Bettis is over here. Let's go shake hands. That is what the Super Bowl is about. The Super Bowl is everything from a brand perspective that makes the NFL what it is. All of these brand partners are coming there because they want to be associated with what the NFL stands for. And that, at the end of the day, is why I love the Super Bowl, because I think it encapsulates what makes the NFL special. It's the brand. It's the shield. It's the affinity and the closeness to the NFL. And you really only get that on that one amazing week in February where people show up from around the world to maybe watch a good game. I hope it's a good game. But it's everything leading up to the game, the concerts, the parties, the events, the meet and greets, will make the Super Bowl what it is. That's, I think, why I love the Super Bowl. Now, the history of it, as I mentioned, started with that Johnny Unitas, Indianapolis Colts versus Giants game. And that had millions of viewers on TV. And people said, wow, this football thing, this might be a thing, right? 1959, this is pretty exciting. And then that turned into, in the 60s and 70s, that Green Bay Packers versus Chiefs game that became Super Bowl I. And then over time, this event, because it's so made for TV, the ads became a part of it. And so now, I mean, think about your last Super Bowl party. It's the one game a year where, like, people are talking through the game and they're quiet through the ads. And you never see that anywhere else. It's because the ads in and of itself have become an attraction for the Super Bowl. So, I mean, it's a fascinating, fascinating property. And it's the whole reason why people want to be associated with the NFL.
Let's start to look forward a little bit now for the NFL. Roger Goodell very publicly said, hey, by 2027, we're going to hit 25 billion. We've talked about how they're around 15 billion today. Think about in the next 5 years, they crushed that goal. What did they do really right? And what happens in the macro environment?
This is good. I think they're on their way for a couple of reasons. The TV deals have some step-ups in them. They have some contracted revenue, but then they also have some upside revenue. So I think if it moves to digital media, that's probably one big driver. So you've got your local rights, your linear TV rights, but then you've also got your digital streaming rights. That could be a massive driver. Sports betting is a new one. Just in the first couple of years, I think publicly they announced they generated between $250 and $300 million just on sports betting. That is a high margin product. It's pretty solid if the NFL is actually able to sort of sanction and approve it from certain partners, as opposed to what was happening, which was kind of dark market in Vegas and other places. So that could go from a $300 million property to a $1 billion property over the next 5 years if they're generating new fans. International, I think, is really interesting. And having worked on some of those projects, I think the league has made some headway in markets like the UK and other European markets. I think longtime NFL fans probably remember NFL Europa, which was a spring development league for many years, shut down, I think, just due to lack of investment.
That's how Kurt Warner, my hero, got his start.
That's right. Well, we should talk about our mutual love of Kurt Warner. But yeah, I mean, I think that is just an amazing example of a development league where the NFL really doesn't have anything of the like. The NFL development league right now is NCAA football. NFL Europe, if they potentially expand out to that and they're able to grow an audience that way, I know there have been expansion opportunities that folks have explored in China, in Japan, in Korea, in India. That's 2.5 billion people across those four countries that I mentioned. Massive opportunity to grow the sport there. But the challenge is, unlike soccer, baseball to a degree, which you see in, you know, Latin America, and even hockey, which you see in sort of Canada and a lot of the Nordic countries, there isn't a culture of playing American football in schools. Some of what makes the NFL as powerful here is that kids start playing as early as 5, 6 years old. Then as they grow up, they grow into NFL fans and they grow into people that are going to play on Sundays. You just don't have that in other countries. Where I think like the MLS maybe is not actually filling its shoes the way it could be because of just the massive pool of talent and how big soccer as a sport on the high school level is. It just hasn't made its way on the national stage the way that it has internationally. The NFL has the inverse problem. Nobody is playing football unless they are directly connected to somebody who's American or grew up watching the sport in some way outside the US. So I still believe, I think international could be a massive opportunity. I think international TV rights is probably where it's going to start. Sky Sports and the equivalents that are out in Europe could potentially be multi-billion dollar assets. And then consumer products. I mentioned NFTs, but somewhat tongue in cheek, but there are probably other collectibles and things that the NFL could start selling directly, as opposed to like the black market for Kurt Warner jerseys that you see on eBay. So there's other ways that stuff that is already happening in the wild, the NFL could bring in-house or at least license out where they could generate some additional revenue. So they're on their way.
Yeah, or even like a Super Bowl, like if I had an NFT that said I went to XYZ Super Bowl, very verified. So it sounds like digital media, international, some maybe additional collectibles, merchandise. Is there anything else maybe? And let me ask it in a provocative way. If you were the commissioner of the NFL, is something they're not doing that you would be doing to try to blow through that $25 billion goal?
Well, look, they're trading like a software business right now, but there's not a lot of software components that are owned and operated by the NFL. Fantasy football to a degree, but where is the software relationship that the fan has? Right now, as a fan, my affiliation with the NFL is with my team, and it's with the broadcast partners that I'm watching the NFL through. But I think there's interesting ways that the NFL can develop direct relationship with the fan. I mentioned fantasy because that's one way, right? If you play on the NFL fantasy app, you have a direct relationship with the NFL. The best consumer brands that we see that grow into billion-dollar valuations are the ones that have a direct relationship with their fan. They have newsletters, they're selling products directly, they communicate with their fans. There are 100 million, generally, fans of the NFL in the United States. If you wanted to put an average revenue per user on there, if you're trying to get to $25 billion, what's that ARPU? We're talking about $250 a fan, roughly? Okay, so now the NFL has to think about, I'm applying software metrics to running a traditionally old school business, but that's the way that I would do it. I would say, okay, how are we generating $250 of revenue per fan? I have to take into that account that some of this stuff is licensed out. So yeah, maybe somebody's buying $200 of equipment from Nike, but I'm not seeing $250 of revenue from that. And I'm taking a cut from Nike for my licensing. That's probably the way that I would approach it, is if you want to grow like a software business, you have to operate on software metrics. And so I break it down to the number of users and say, okay, I've got my avids, I've got my casuals, and I've got my general fans. I have an ARPU for my avids, I have an ARPU for my casuals. Maybe $50 a year I make from the regular fans that are watching the Super Bowl or something like that. That's the level that we have to get to. And maybe there's folks internally at the NFL that are thinking about it that way, but at a broad level, that's probably not the way the NFL views its business.
Now let's flip it around. So they totally whiff on that goal. Obviously, if they don't get digital right, they don't get international right. Are there other things that are big risks for the business or generally concerns that would cause them to whiff on that goal majorly?
The word relevance came up before. Colin Kaepernick, vaccines. It's hard to not talk about how politics has permeated football. It is, unfortunately, a toxicity that comes with it. And so when you have people that are saying, oh, well, the NFL is woke now, or the NFL isn't supporting its players enough, or something like that. The reason it all comes back to the NFL is because that's by design. It's not the Patriots aren't woke. It's the NFL isn't woke. So you got to think about it that way. But that can affect relevance. It's about tearing down what the shield stands for. And do brands want to be associated with what the shield stands for? Look, generally, I think my former colleagues that are still there are doing a really good job shepherding through some challenging dynamics. It comes with being a 365-day-a-year product, is that you will have issues and headaches 365 days a year. And in this case, whether it's abuse and domestic violence, whether it is the flag and anthem controversies, whether it's the vaccination controversies, or just the stuff that happened with John Gruden and caught on tape saying abhorrent things, all of this affects the relevance of the league and cascades beyond just the fans. Because if the sponsors say, well, I don't think people are going to buy our product if they think we're associated with the NFL, not only will they not hit that goal, but they could actually lose on some of the major sponsorship deals that they have today. The TV rights, I think it's so symbiotic that I can't imagine a TV rights partner walking away from the NFL because it's losing relevance, because frankly, the next day that TV partner would also lose relevance. So much of their advertising is tied up to the NFL. But the sponsors, they might say, listen, F1 speaks to us a little bit better than the NFL does. So we're going to take our ad dollars and we're going to take it to a different asset. But the relevance challenge cascades in a lot of different ways out from the NFL.
What about CTE? I mean, that's something we haven't really talked about, the people coming into the sport. Is that a concern at all if you're the commissioner?
It has to be not only for the people that are coming into the league, but it has to be for the thousands of players that have played for your sport before. When you have tragic situations like what happened with Junior Seau, any of these other players that played and have really, really struggled with mental developmental issues after their NFL career, it reflects badly on the brand. It just does. The league has done, I think, quite a bit in the last decade, setting up funds, setting up support, setting up health and benefits for current players so that they don't end up in situations where their medical bills are bankrupting them. But that is a constant issue with the game. You're seeing a lot of stuff that's happening on the safety side, no launching with your helmet, so on and so forth. But then you also have fans on the back end saying, oh, well, it's taking away the game that I love. I watch it for the violence. Okay, but you also know that in aggregate, that violence actually takes away from the longevity of the sport. And so that remains a challenge.
Are they seeing less and less players at the front end choosing football? And
so I don't think that the data proves that out directly as a result of CTE. But yes, there is less interest in people playing sports at all levels. So not just football, basketball, soccer, hockey. And the reason for that is because most of these folks that would be playing now have the option to go be esports. I'm going to play Madden instead of playing football, less injury, and I can sit on my butt. The youth participation in youth sports has gone down. The headlines and the media want to make it about CTE, but it's a drop across the board. Maybe the drop in football is a little bit higher than the drop in other sports. We don't know if it's directly because of CTE or other injuries, or as the NBA becomes a bigger league in the US, players might say, I can be LeBron James or Aaron Rodgers. They get paid the same amount and I just take a little less injury. And if you're over 6'5", go with football, man. Go with basketball. What are you doing going with football? And so I think that's maybe some of the other reasons that you're seeing youth participation drop. But I would be less concerned about youth participation. If there's 53 men on an NFL roster and there are 32 teams, we can find the players to play football. But I think it's really about the interest from fans that continues to keep the sport relevant.
Three questions we ask everyone: lessons for builders, lessons for investors, and then where can someone go to learn more about the NFL and maybe the business of sport? So let's just take them one at a time. So when you think about this, a business, if you're an executive or an entrepreneur out there, what's the big one lesson from the NFL?
Everything is media. So we talked about this a little bit earlier. The NFL excels at taking things that are cost centers and turning them into media properties. Draft, combine, kickoff, playoffs and Super Bowl. Like, you have to have the playoffs, but why are the playoffs such a big media property? Why are the advertising dollars so high? And I think if a builder realizes, we hear startups that are building in public and things like that, yeah, you're creating media. You have to do this stuff anyway. Invest a little bit more time to write a Twitter thread or share a video or something like that. And now you generate interest and audience. And I think what the NFL excels at is taking things that they would be doing in the dark, packaging them up, and putting them out there for consumption. You can do that too. You could get there soon. I figured you would, Jesse. So that's probably right up your alley.
What's the lesson for investors? I guess all the owners are investors, but what's an investor lesson from this business?
I think it's just about the idea of thinking long-term. The best teams really take a 5 to 7 year approach. And it may not feel like that on the field. If you're a fan of the team, you want to win today. You feel like your window with your quarterback is closing, yada, yada, yada. But from a business standpoint, the best teams are investing for the long term. They're investing in the brand today so that when they build that giant stadium, all of those corporate suites are filled. Sometimes as an investor, you just have to be willing to take pain a little bit longer in terms of your investment and not seeing return on it in order to unlock that in the future. I think the added challenge, talked about everything is media at the top, but as an investor, when everything is media, then those wins and losses are also very public. And so you see that with a lot of NFL owners and team ownerships, where they've made investments, they maybe haven't paid off in the near term, and they're taking a lot of licks for it because NFL is quintessentially American. then impatience is also quintessentially American. And so people want to see results right away, but we know that good investments take time. So I would say for investors, it's just about having the patience and looking long term.
And where would you guide someone who wants to go learn about the NFL and maybe just the business of sports?
Well, it's going to sound a little self-serving, but I host a weekly podcast called The Game Plan, where I speak with professional athletes about what they do off the field and how they spend their money. And as a result of that, we talk a little bit about the business of each of those leagues. We've had the presidents of the NFLPA, MLBPA, NBAPA that have come on and talked to us about how they manage that. Then also about some of the ancillary aspects of, you know, athletes that are starting their own brands. They can come and reach out to us. And then obviously follow me on Twitter. I tweet about this stuff pretty regularly as well. So I'm at JKapoorNYC on Twitter.
And what's your favorite book on the business of sports or the NFL?
There's a couple of really good ones. The first one that my manager gave me when I joined the NFL was one called Tailgating Sacks and Salary Caps. It's a little bit old. Some of the numbers you'd have to refresh, because I think this was written before the 2011 CBA was passed. But it really gave me a good understanding. And then there's actually a couple of white papers out there, and you know, maybe I can find them and we can link them for you, Jesse. Again, probably from 2013 or 14. That actually talk about, like, it's a business textbook that talks about the media rights breakdown and the history of the media rights. And so I read this stuff religiously while I was interviewing. And then I got the book when I got the job, and it sort of all started to come together and make sense over time. And then just being a history buff, when I would find somebody who had been at the NFL for 30 years and corner them in the cafeteria, I would say, yeah, tell me about scheduling. How did that guy do it all in his head for 30 years? Some of this is also stuff that you can find publicly online.
Awesome. Well, Jay, this was super fascinating and personally very gratifying. So thank you for breaking down the NFL.
I appreciate it, Jesse. This was a lot of fun for me, and I hope folks learned something new about their favorite sport.
To find more episodes of Breakdowns ranging from Costco to Visa to Moderna, or to sign up for our weekly summary, check out joincolossus.com. That's JOINCOLOSSUS.com.